Okay, now we're going to leap into the 20th century. We're going to leave the philosophical and the theological arguments behind. We're going to assume certain aspects of the human condition. And now we're going to examine what the wisdom of the ages, the use and the abuse of power, has wrought in the bloodiest century in all human history. You know, it's interesting. Go back to Mary's question about whether man is good or bad. If we're progressing, if man is perfectible, basically good, you'd think that as the march of time unfolds, there would be less mayhem. The contrary seems to be happening. All that man's material progress seems to be producing is a way to kill on a broader and more efficient basis in many respects, as we talk about man's relationship to man. Don't misunderstand me. As we are talking about the economics and the philosophy, which we will see quite accurately that the basis for the 20th century and all that we understand and observe and know about it, really you have to start somewhere. And you can say that the ideas that are paramount in the 20th century probably have as good a genesis point as any in 1776. Not just because of the Declaration of Independence, which most Americans clearly understand, even some of our college graduates know that, but there were a couple of other things that happened in 1776. It's one of those seminal years, a sea change year, where there are a few of them in history, and I won't regale you with those, but take my word for it, 1776 is only one. Declaration of Independence, the idea, the codifying of the idea that government is responsible to the governed, that all of government's powers are derived from the governed. And that, in the argument of is man good or bad, that famous statement of Thomas Jefferson's, let us hear no more of confidence in man, rather let us bind them down from mischief with chains of the Constitution. But also in 1776, two other things were launched. The Scotsman Adam Smith wrote his book on the wealth of nations. And in the material sense, its effect on what followed was ever bit as great as the codification that we saw in the Declaration of Independence and the subsequent Constitution and Bill of Rights in the United States. And in Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith argued, as an extension of this philosophical framework here, an economic idea, that the greatest good for the greatest number comes when people are allowed to operate most freely as they go about the pursuit of their own self-interest as perceived by themselves. And that those nations which sponsor and encourage that idea create wealth. Those nations who don't, don't. Now, you would think with all of the lessons of the Psalms and the ancient wisdom and all the rest that this idea would have been codified before that. But mankind is not a quick study. And so the Wealth of Nations created the basis for the contemporary economic idea, the modern economic idea, the free market, if you will, the laissez-faire, if you will. Before that, not too far before that, the crown owned everything. The crown made all decisions as to life and death and mercantilism and trade and everything else. We will talk about how man is about to fall back into that error of the ages in our next session. But the wealth of nations was a very important intellectual happening. There was something else very important that happened in 1776, and that was a codification of deception founded by a renegade professor at Ingolstadt in Bavaria by the name of Adam Weishaupt, where Weishaupt created something called the Order of Illuminati, or the Order of the Enlightened. And Weishaupt, like others who had planned deceptions and plots and cabals, codified mechanisms for bringing about the accumulation through the pursuit of power. And this Order of Illuminati of Adam Weishaupt did a very important thing. It codified something that Machiavelli had written about, and that is that if you're going to bring about power, you have to seduce those who are essentially powerful. And through deception and the use of that power, weld a coalition with those who are basically powerless but are full of envy. Then if the top working with the bottom, top financing, top directing, utilizing the masses, as it were, they can drive at the potential threat to their power, which is the burgeoning middle class. Now, the Order of Illuminati, the Declaration of Independence, the Wealth of Nations, all of those things are pertinent and irrevocably bound up in what we see going on in the 20th century. I'm happy to report to you that with the exception of the French Revolution in 1789 and the German Revolution in 1848, the ascending ideas of the age from 1776 through up to the turn of this century, the 20th century, the more dominant ideas, the ones that captivated the minds of men, were more those of Jefferson, Madison, and Adam Smith than those of Adam Weishaupt and his collaborators in their conspiracy for power. Many little things about the French Revolution not widely known. So many myths exist, purposefully rewritten to give off a false impression, particularly when that false impression has a very important play in today's view of the world. The French Revolution, for example, most students, if they study it at all, are convinced that the French Revolution was a result of the downtrodden masses rising up against the exploiting enchant regime of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. The brutalities of Louis and Marie were so bad that the French people just couldn't stand it. Wrong, wrong, wrong. And as while we're clarifying a few things, Marie Antoinette never said, "Let them eat cake." That was a creation of a revolutionary propagandist. And I might add, the propaganda techniques of the French Revolution are very much alive and well in contemporary times. How you throw out these slurs and then give them life. What most don't know, if they study the revolution at all, they understand the role of Marat, Robespierre, the Reign of Terror. But what they don't know is that the revolution was primarily the handiwork of the Grand Orient Lodge operating in Paris, which was dominated by the Order of Illuminati, the Sons of the Enlightened, and the most powerful, wealthiest man in France was not Louis XVI, the king, it was his cousin, Philippe the Duc d'Orléans, who was envious and lustful of the power of that regime and financed the revolution. The top and the bottom working together. And much was written about it. Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke. An intelligent and educated age knew the story, the truth of the French Revolution. It's only in today's time that such myths abound. But let me not get diverted. French Revolution, as well as Roman history, is one of my favorite study areas. As you see, I'm intrigued with how well conspirators can pull this stuff off. Now, when you take a look at the 20th century, you say, okay, you see the effects of those three events. But where does the 20th century start? Well, when Gary and I wrote None Dare Call It Conspiracy, we picked up the thread in 1885. Because it was at that time that an Oxford don by the name of John Ruskin, collaborating with some of the wealthiest and the powerful in England, created something called the Round Table Group. And in the Round Table Group were such enlightened people as, and I put enlightened quotes, Lord Lothian, Cecil Rhodes of South Africa Rhodesian fame, Lord Rothschild, Alfred Milner, the man who succeeded Rhodes in all of the South African wealth, and their minions, commonly referred to as Milner's kindergarten. But what did Ruskin have to do with all this? Ruskin gave these men a vision of how the world should be ruled. He did what Weishaupt did with the Order of Illuminati 100 years earlier, a mechanism through which their dominance could be brought about through what he called Anglo-American ascendancy. And it was this vision of Ruskin, who was an intellectual powerhouse, a scoundrel, but an intellectual powerhouse, who motivated the likes of Milner, Rhodes, Lothian, Stead, Rothschild, etc. Now, when you study what Ruskin believed, and then when you study another idea in its ascendancy, Marx, let me just do a sidebar on Marx. Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto in 1847. It wasn't even called that at first. It didn't even have his name on it. He was kind of a hack political writer who, along with Frederick Engels, was commissioned to write a revolutionary tract that was going to be used in a revolution that the revolutionaries were planning for 1848. Those revolutionaries were an outgrowth of the Order of Illuminati called the League of the Just. And out of it, they called themselves communists. And the Communist Manifesto didn't even carry Marx's name for probably 20 years. It wasn't a powerful economic document. It was just a revolutionary tract. And I don't know how many have ever read Karl Marx, Das Kapital, but you talk about temporal punishment due to sin. Boy, that really is trying to slug your way through that nonsense. The Communist Manifesto is pretty concise. And, you know, and it's all built around envy. The Marxian idea is built around one permanent idea, envy, class hatred. And the abolition of those sanctifying qualities in man that allows him to overcome such great sins as envy. But Ruskin, Marx were dependent on Hegel. Now, Hegel developed the idea of what we call the dialectic. In other words, the process of how change is brought about. If change is going to happen in society, how does that change take place? Well, among the other many things that Hegel talked about, he talked about that process of change, and he called it the dialectic. Let me explain. It's not a very difficult concept, but an important one to understand. Hegel postulated that take any point in time, you have an existing condition, a predominant condition, an economic condition, if you will, a prevailing school of thought, if you will. Call it what Hegel called it, the thesis. And then he also said that at the same time that there is the thesis, there are those in argument with that, for whatever reason, altruistic, selfless, and you have the antithesis. And that it is this permanent struggle between the thesis and the antithesis that brings about change, which he called the synthesis. And once the synthesis is developed, then the synthesis becomes the new thesis. A new antithesis is in place instantly, and the struggle continues, out of which comes another synthesis, and so on the process. And because that idea captivated the intellectual community in the latter half of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th, dialectics became more than a philosophical school of thought. It became a methodology for bringing about political change. Even to the point of, as Machiavelli points out in here, and I could get you the quote, take the time, but he says that a smart prince will occasionally create his own opposition because it's easier to handle, and there's going to be some opposition, and by creating your own opposition, once you squash it, you're a big man. Not a bad idea. It has been done many times. And so this philosophy of Hegel not only permeated the thinking of Marx and the communist revolutionaries, as we came to call them, the Bolsheviki, but it also was an integral part of the methodology and the view adopted by Ruskin and his Round Table group. Now, in developing the idea that the pursuit of power is the ultimate aim of the powerful, both Marx and Ruskin agreed with this welding of the intelligent and powerful to the masses to create a pincers movement on the middle. The middle has always been the threat to this power. And it's easy, if you have the power and the influence, to convince this group down here, that their problem isn't this group. Their problem is middle-class values. How many times do you hear the professors on the college campus rallying against the elite? The object of the scorn are those middle-class values. Those holdovers. So, you see, that adopted idea was pretty well understood by Machiavelli in the 15th century, certainly understood by Ruskin in the 19th century, and Marx in the 18th century, or 19th century. Now, when Ruskin founded the Round Table Group, he knew that he had the power through that group to bring about a vision of world rule. But this vision of world rule contained in it the necessity to break down the sovereignty of the United States and Great Britain, primarily. They had to be welded together as a political economic force. And that if the Brits and the Americans, the Anglo-Americans as they were called, could be brought in unity to pursue this world goal, ultimate sovereignty would give way in other venues, and a world order, as they called it, would be established. And Ruskin was a very convincing fellow. And he could convince a lot of people depending on their various motivations. And I'm not about to say that all the people who bought in on Ruskin's worldview or his roundtable group were doing so out of basically or inherently evil. But one thing I've learned about powerful people, the wealthier and the more powerful they are, the more susceptible they are to flattery and sycophancy. One of the interesting parallels of history is as you watch the power of a particular person grow. Pick a person, I don't care. Pick anyone in history. Let's start with Saul. And finish with Nixon. As their power grows, their paranoia goes right with it. The more powerful, the more paranoid. And as you leaf through the pages of history, you'll find it time after time after time. So it doesn't take much of a psychologist to figure out how you cozy up to the wealthy and the powerful. You play on their paranoia, and you play on their desire to be loved and accepted, and their leadership greeted and acknowledged. Machiavelli. Boy, what a bootlicker. So in convincing the wealthy, one of the most early converts in American wealth to the Anglo-American world order idea of Ruskin's was Andrew Carnegie. And Carnegie was convinced, through the combined efforts of Ruskin and an American lawyer, a devotee of Ruskin's worldview, Elihu Root, that he should use his wealth, great wealth, to build this idea, this worldview, this philosophy, as it were, of the elite governing. Certainly, Andrew Carnegie was convinced that, and he was too much of a gentleman to say so, Harry Hopkins was lesser of a gentleman, but he believed in the Hopkins idea that people were too damn dumb to know what was good for them. So he set up this huge philanthropy. It gives you some idea of Carnegie's view of himself. It was called the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Now that's a presumptuous title, folks. But nonetheless, the man who convinced him to do this was Elihu Root, the New York lawyer, Secretary of State, counselor. Ruskin's man on the scene, as it were, in the United States. And the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace set about the process of shaping the American mentality. And because they understood, Ruskin being an educator, they knew how that process would have to be shaped. You do it in the classrooms of the elite. You do it in the classrooms where the sons and daughters of the mighty and the powerful go. You start at the top. You start at Harvard and Yale and Princeton, and then you create things like the University of Chicago and Johns Hopkins. You build a library system. You put out study papers. You put on bright young people that you can shape and mold to this idea through fellowships and scholarships. And the idea, the Ruskin idea, was transplanted into the United States before the turn of the century. You want an interesting pursuit, go to a library and take a look if your library has it. I'm sure maybe next time you're in Austin, go take a look and see if you can take a look at the annual report of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and pick a year somewhere around 1910. See what the program of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace was then. You'll see how little things have changed. Now, when we take a look at how do you bring about change in society, well, the history would indicate that the single most efficient way for bringing about sea change in society is war. War is that condition whereby you can get people to willingly go along with more breaches against their freedom, economic and otherwise, than any other mechanism. Shakespeare, "Be it thy course, my son, to busy giddy mind with foreign quarrels." When things get tough on the home front, create a war. Besides, it's good for business. Now, at the end of the 19th century, the end of the Victorian Age, which I personally believe was the high watermark of Western civilization, their Western culture and civilization was reaching out, spreading in the best sense, the noblesse oblige of the day. Call it the white man's burden, if you will. But civilization was being spread to the world. And the world was better for it. Remember that all primitive societies are captivated by one idea, sustenance. You measure the intellectual development, the philosophical development of a society one way. The amount of leisure time available. And it's only through a rise in standard of living that you get leisure time availability. The Greeks understood this. Those who would philosophize first must eat. Quoted Aristotle. But this spreading of hegemony or power around the world posed a threat to the vision of Ruskin. It also posed a threat to the followers of Marx, who were not one and the same at that point in time. There's a welding coming on here, which we'll discuss in a minute. And so the conditions were created whereby a necessary war could be fought. A war to end all wars, as it were. A war to make the world safe for democracy, it was called. The big one, WW1. And there were a lot of excuses used to bring about that war. It was not easy to get people to go marching off to war. particularly Americans, they were not really excited about that idea. The farewell address of George Washington of not getting involved in Europe's internal struggles was still fresh on the consciousness of the American mind. Took a little effort. Might be of interest to recall, of course, that one of those things that was used to bring about a condition for hostilities was the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo. The Balkans, that so many of these contemporary followers of Ruskin are so anxious to get us to go into now. It's really kind of laughable were it not so tragic. Can anybody in this room, can anybody who views this videotape, I don't care how long from now it is, tell me who the good guys and the bad guys are there? This is not an easy one to sell because you see through television and constant mental preparation, Americans like simple good guy, bad guy. That, you know, Saddam, he was perfect. Perfect foil. But I have studied the situation in the Balkans. In its historical context, in its contemporary context, there ain't no all good guys and there ain't no all bad guys. They're just people struggling and fighting and grabbing turf and doing the same things that tribes do down through the centuries. The atrocities aren't all one way. If you think the Serbs are the bad guys, you don't know anything about the history of the area. Remember, it was the Serbian leader, Mihailovic, who was fighting Nazis on one hand and communists on the other, was drugged into the square of Belgrade and summarily hung by Marshal Tito, the great Croat. So there are no good guys there. But war, that was important. The sinking of the Lusitania and all the other things. And Wilson, when he ran for re-election in 1916, he ran under the banner, the man who kept us out of war. All the while, Colonel House and the American branch of the Round Table Group were busy planning our entry into World War I in collaboration with the Roundtable Group in England. And so we have the war to end all wars and the war to make the world safe for democracy. And to this day, here we are, oh, some, what, 75 years later? I don't know anybody who can actually say what the real, if any, valid reasons for fighting World War I were. Today, most historians agree it was the most unnecessary war ever fought. But it did serve the purposes of the insiders, the Anglo-American establishment, because it got them at the end of the war, it gave them the ability to do what they most wanted to do, draw new lines on the map. Change the nature of sovereignty. Create an international political organization. The League of Nations. You know what it was called before it was called the League of Nations? When it was just in the idea stage? Needed a little PR twist, as you can tell. The League to Enforce Peace. Whoa, League to Enforce Peace, whoa. That don't sound so good. Well, if you don't like that, how about the League of Nations, the Parliament of Man, the lion laying down with the lamb, beating our swords into plowshares, and redrawing the lines on the map, and creating world courts. That was the major objective, to create the world court, where your justice system becomes sublimated to a world justice system. Americans have no idea how important their justice system is. And in the process, they are losing it. There isn't one lawyer in 1,000 today who understands the philosophy of the common law. There isn't one lawyer in 1,000 today who even reads Blackstone. They study case law. Our law schools are turning out armies of pragmatists who care nothing for permanent values or the history of the philosophy of the common law. And so they are always in the forefront of ready to rewrite the law and submit it to international tribunals. We've adopted the idea, we've been sold the idea, that somehow this is the wise course. And at the end of World War I, as the victor sat down at the councils in Europe, the Paris Peace Conference, the Versailles Conference, the redrawing of the map started. You know how you can have, you know you're going to have trouble in any given area at any given time? Surefire way. When you see a map dividing countries and the line is either like this or like this, you know you got trouble. Straight lines are trouble. Straight lines are political demarcations. Whenever you see a straight line on the map, you know it was drawn by a group of politicians. So there were a whole lot of straight lines drawn on the map of Europe after World War I. And as one British diplomat said, this is not a peace conference, this is simply a succession of hostilities that will begin again in less than one generation. He was off the tenure, so what? But the war succeeded in accomplishing what the wise men, as they now call themselves, wanted. An international organization, League of Nations. Americans had become used to the idea of abandoning the old Washingtonian idea of not involving themselves in foreign conflicts and foreign wars. Americans were given that idea of a manifest destiny that you too, along with other English-speaking people, it is your destiny to rule and lead the world. It's not your destiny to shut up and mind your own business and take care of what's best for you and your families and build a better life. No, we were sold the idea of internationalism. And at the end of World War One, the Round Table Group set up a group of organizations, one called the Royal Institutes for International Affairs. And these Royal Institutes were set up everywhere in the English-speaking world. Canada, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, India. But that royal isn't really a palatable word to Americans. So it wasn't called Royal Institute. It was for about a year till the PR boys got it. Got changed to the Council on Foreign Relations. So the Royal Institutes for International Affairs became the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States. Founded by that same group of wise men who had been in the Wilson administration and determining how the world should work, and who had been very instrumental in getting us involved in World War I in the first place, Mr. Elihu Root, Mr. Henry L. Stimson, Mr. J.P. Morgan, and the Morgan partners, Colonel Edward M. House, the gray eminence of the Wilson administration. He had around him a group of bright young men at the Paris Peace Conference called the Whiz Kids. The Whiz Kids included Walter Lippmann, John and Foster Dulles, Christian Herter, all who would become in their own time wise men. Through what they called the meritocracy. To become a wise man, you did not only have to be to the manner born, that helped, but if you were smart enough, ruthless enough, brilliant enough to see the handwriting on the wall and become part of that through what the Round Table Group themselves called the meritocracy, you could rise. That included some pretty bright guys. Walter Lippmann. Some of you younger people don't remember Lippmann. But Lippmann became the most powerful man in the American press by a country mile. The whole establishment press used to wait and see what Walter had to say before they'd write their columns or their op-ed pieces. Because to go against Lippmann was to go against the voice of God. And after the war, with the establishment of the Council on Foreign Relations, then it used its prestige, its power, and its influence to draw in others from business, from government, from the academy. And certain men were studying this. When Gary and I wrote Nundare, one of the breakthrough books that led to my, and I should point out, Nundare Call It Conspiracy started off as me giving a lengthy lecture like this. Gary hearing it and saying, let's turn it into a book. Okay, sounds like a good idea. And God bless Roz Haley, who helped us fund it to get it started. But one of the breakthrough books was a book called Tragedy and Hope for Us. This was a book written by a Georgetown professor named Carol Quigley, who understood, spent his life, as he acknowledged, spent his whole adult life studying this network, this Anglo-American network. Listen to what Quigley says about this in his Tragedy and Hope. It's a 1,300-page, 8-pound tome written in 1967. Quigley says, I know the operations of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have for much of my life been close to it and to many of its instruments. I have objected, both in the past and recently, to a few of its policies. But in general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known. Close quote. Now, that Quigley wasn't the only person who saw this and wrote about it enthusiastically. There were many others. My library is full of books that where the disclosures are every bit as revealing as Carol Quigley's. But for our purposes, Quigley is extremely important. Because you recall that during the Democrat convention of 1992, when Bill Clinton was there to accept the nomination of his party, in the course of his speech, he acknowledged only three people as helping shape his life. His mother, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and Carol Quigley. And I felt quickly, felt a little bit like that great line in Patton where George C. Scott sitting there looking at Rommel's troops. I read your book, USOB. You see, among the other things that the wise men established when they set up the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the Council on Foreign was something called the Rhodes Scholarship Program. The Rhodes Will was established to bring bright young Americans to England to be taught the principles of Ruskin and a world view under the Rhodes Scholarship. And if you want an interesting tracking of the wise men, track the Rhodes Scholars. See how many of them are part of Mr. Clinton's clique. In 1958, the concern for the Rhodes Scholarship was strong enough among other tax-exempt foundations, like the Carnegie Endowment, which was later followed by the Rockefeller Fund, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, the Ford Foundation. In the late 1940s, early 50s, a committee of Congress was set up. It was called the Special Committee to Investigate Tax-Exempt Foundations. And it was chaired by Congressman B. Carroll Reese of Tennessee. The legal counsel to the committee in 1953 was Rene Wormser, a very respected lawyer from Connecticut. And the director of research was Mr. Norman Dodd. After the committee was finally put out of business, Mr. Wormser wrote a book in 1958 called Foundations, Their Power and Influence, where he took the work of the Reese Committee, of which he was chief counsel, and Mr. Dodd is chief of research, and looked at their power and influence. And it was a frightening look in 1958. And I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, having read Wormser's book years ago and tracked this, the power and influence that Wormser saw then as a result of the Reese Committee's investigation was chump change compared to what it is today. But let me just salt this, spice it with just this one idea. The foundations under critical examination were the Carnegie Endowment, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Rhodes Scholarship Trust. In addition to the Foreign Policy Association and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Institute for Pacific Relations. But then in taking a look at the Rhodes Scholarship Fund, Mr. Wormser writes, at least one foreign foundation has had a strong influence on our foreign policy. The Rhodes Scholarship Fund, not registered here as a foreign agent, it has gained great influence in the United States. It has accomplished this by annually selecting a choice group of promising young men for study in England. Then he quotes Mr. Frank Adelotz, himself a Rhodes Scholar, who wrote a book called The Rhodes Trust, 1903 to 1953. Adelotz, bragging, one of the boys, one of the wise men, says, quote, the influence of this group in American institutions of higher learning has been immense. The number of those going into government is constantly increasing, close quote. That was 40 years ago. Now, hold the thought. Because right at the end of World War I was something else that took place of seminal importance. The Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And again, like the misbegotten ideas of the French Revolution of the downtrodden masses rising up against the exploiting bosses, Americans have been taught that that was the thing that brought the Bolsheviks to power in Russia. The brutal regime of Nicholas and Alexander. Now, granted, the Russians had some pretty brutal czars down through the years, but if there was one who was not brutal, it was Tsar Nicholas II. What wasn't also understood, as we look back now, is that Russia was becoming a major industrial threat to the Anglo-American idea. In the 10 years prior to World War I, the Russian economy grew faster than any European economy by, in some cases, some monumental factors. And you can go to Russia today, as I have, and as Paul has, and you will see that it was almost like, come November 17th, the clock stopped. All the beauty in that which is there was there before then, still there in rundown condition. That which was built after it is ugly and unworkable. But It was the same wise men who set up the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institutes for International Affairs who also helped finance the Bolsheviks into power. The record on it is clear. Now, there were varying methods and methodologies and even motives for doing that. Those in England, many were convinced that by financing the Bolsheviks into power, they would be able to do a deal with the Bolsheviks that they couldn't do with the Romanovs. The Germans, on the other hand, who helped finance them into power, some of them, were convinced that if they financed the Bolsheviks into power who were opposing World War I, they could sign a separate, sue for a separate peace treaty on the Eastern Front and not have to fight a two-front war. But there were others who financed Lenin into power that had a much longer view. Now let's quickly retrace the events of 1917. It wasn't the Bolsheviks who upset the Romanovs. That happened in March of 1917 when Tsar Nicholas abdicated in favor of Prince Lvov, a cousin, who wanted to build a Russian Republic modeled after the United States Republic and set up a constituent assembly and spoke with great eloquence and enthusiasm that we in Russia can be just like the United States if we bring that sort of Republican form of government to Russia and allow this backward country to grow in the face of that. And you know what? Tsar Nicholas, not being the brutal autocrat that he's been painted, I'm going with that. Then the socialists got in there with Kerensky and undermined the Republican or the strict constitutionalist of Prince Lvov. You had the Kerensky regime, which came to ascendancy in July. And that was a polyglot group, including Mensheviks, Bolsheviks, whites, reds. And then it was in September that Lenin left Switzerland in the sealed train with the gold provided by the Germans, Max Warburg. And Trotsky, who had been in exile in the United States, left the ship in New York with the money provided by Max's brother Paul Warburg and others. They met in Finland and they went in, cut a deal with the Navy through bribery, brutality, overthrew the Kerensky regime, and through the barrel of a gun, like Mao Zedong said, established their power. And then spent the next 4 years pushing that power down on the backs of the Russian people. There was no popular uprising among the Russians to instill the Bolsheviks. Nothing could be further from the truth. And yet, you ask any high school student today, college student, how did communism come to Russia in the first place? Well, downtrodden masses rising up against exploiting Bolsheviks. No. And so communism as a dynamic became part of it. Now, in chronicling that, volumes, thousands of books have been written about what really happened, how it happened. And let me just say parenthetically, there have been a lot of books written that will make the case that Bolshevism was nothing more than a Jewish plot, financed by Jews, acted upon by Jews, and that communism was a Jewish conspiracy. If you want to take a look at the evidence is far greater that it was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant conspiracy. At least the Jews had a reason. At least the Warburgs had a reason. At least Jacob Schiff had a reason. The Tsars, the Romanovs, had been exerting pogroms against the Jews for a long, hundreds of years. And the idea of getting away from the Tsar, like the great prayer of the rabbi and fiddler on the roof, may God bless and keep the Tsar. Yep, may God bless and keep the Tsar far from here. the rationale was there, but there was certainly no rationale for the Rockefellers and the Morgans, especially the Morgans. They were involved. I shouldn't say the Rockefellers. They came in later. But there's no doubt where that influence came from. And then we saw the stage being set, as I said, the cessation of hostilities and the rebuilding of the conditions for another war to end wars, World War II. The real big one. And just like Wilson in 1916, Roosevelt in 1940 ran on the slogan, "He kept us out of war. I promise that I will never send your sons to fight in a foreign war." And at the very time he was saying it, he was lying. Now the apologists for the era say, well, yeah, okay, but Americans were, you know, they weren't ready to go to war, so that was statesmanlike on Roosevelt's part to lie him into war. It was important. Besides, look at how bad Hitler was. Had to do something about that. They're having trouble with that now when we find out that Hitler had bought into the Ruskin idea. All he wanted to do was be part of the Anglo-American ruling establishment. He didn't really want to go to war with England. Certainly not the United States. He just wanted to muscle in on the action. Hitler was an Anglophile. If there was any group of people in the world that he admired, it was the Brits. And if there was any group of people in the world he was scared of, it was the Yankees. So he certainly didn't want any of that action. But as we now know, there were people in the Third Reich who were operating as agents provocateurs. Convince Hitler, like all other megalomaniacs before him in sense, as their power grew, their ambitions grew, and their psychopathy, their susceptibility to psychopathy, and all the rest grew right with it. And so we got World War II. And even before the end of World War II, the wise men, through the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institutes for International Affairs, had developed what they called the United Nations Endgame Plan. You know, the United Nations Conference was held in San Francisco before World War II was over. And in fact, if you take a look at, go back and take a look at the papers of the day, you will see that the Allies stopped being called the Allies and started being called the United Nations in about 1944. An interesting little shift in conditioning for what was to come later. And with the end of World War II, the lines were again redrawn on the map. The spoils of war were again split up. But this time, unlike the first one, the international idea, the surrender of sovereignty to the international idea, was able to be plowed through with incredible audacity. We cover it all in the book, you'll see. And there wasn't even any opposition to speak of. And anybody who opposed the sacrifice of sovereignty to the United Nations on the part of the United States, oh boy, they were the worst sort of holdovers, reactionaries, antediluvians. You may have forgotten, it's not without interest, that the first acting Secretary General of the United Nations was not Mr. Trigvi Lee, it was Mr. Alger Hiss of the State Department. He was the one who presided at San Francisco Conference. But the restructuring of the world had begun. And important in this restructuring of the world, remembering the Hegelian idea of change, how you bring about change, was process of the dialectic. The thesis, the antithesis, the synthesis. The West, communism. And as you go back and study from 1917 forward, you find some very interesting and irrefutable facts. Communism wouldn't have lasted 6 months, probably, if it had not been for the constant infusions of capital and prestige from the West. It is, as my colleague Dr. Anthony Sutton calls it after writing a 3-volume history of the age called Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, he called them the best enemy money could buy. Create your own opposition. And in the name of fighting communism, in the name of keeping the world safe from nuclear holocaust, all sorts of government growth could go on. All sorts of expenditures could be propelled at an ever-accelerating rate. All sorts of sovereignties could be surrendered. All sorts of things could go on in the name of meeting the threat of communism. And you know who created communism as a threat in its contemporary sense? One of the bright young scholars on the Council on Foreign Relations, a fellow by the name of George F. Kennan, who, when he was number 2 man at the State Department in Moscow, wrote a lengthy paper and signed it X. And he created a phrase that dominated American foreign policy for 40 years. The phrase was called containment. Not elimination of, containment. And do you realize how many times we were sold the idea that the Russians or the communists were mellowing and that all they needed to mellow a little bit more was another infusion of your dollars? When you go into the good communist, bad communist routine, it's funny. Remember, first of all, Lenin was a bad communist because the word got out about all the brutalities and the atrocities. But by 1922, he'd become a good communist because he established something called the New Economic Program. Then when Lenin died, Stalin was a bad communist because he had these purges and stuff. But then when World War II came around, he became a good communist, Uncle Joe. And he was a good communist until the containment policies were established in 1946. Then he became a bad communist, but by that time we had a new good communist, Mao Zedong, who was being called the George Washington of China, the Abraham Lincoln of China. Then Stalin died. He was always a bad communist. Then it came Khrushchev, a good communist. And every time we went through this good communist, bad communist routine, American money went in to support the maintenance of that system. The best enemy money could buy. And always the creation of more and more entanglement, surrenders of sovereignty, greater and greater government in the name of meeting the threat of communism. Those of you who've read me for years know that I called it 25 years ago exactly what it was. A paper tiger. It never was a threat. We didn't win the Cold War. We created the Cold War and then called a cessation of those hostilities because there's bigger fish to fry called the New World Order. And it was all put together in the West. When Beatrice and Sidney Webb of the Fabian Society went to Russia, along with Lincoln Steffens of the United States and others, they went there and they met with the Bolsheviks, and they came back and they gushed, "I have seen the future and it works." An Italian communist by the name of Antonio Gramsci went and observed, and he says, "I have seen your system and it won't work. We have to do something else."